Welcome to the Cabaret, the first event of the 2002 State of the Art Symposium on the Future of Electronic Literature. And now I'd like to introduce our first author, Rob Wittig. Only I'm not going to introduce it, I'm just going to play the titles. Rob is pretty well known.
Why do this shit anyway? This electronic literature. Not for the big bucks, nor for the great pension plan, nor for the pure fun of coding, nor for the rabid fan clubs, unless you're the unknown. No, it's because good art helps people, and bad art hurts people. It's because language is a living thing shaped by millions of our ancestors' precious hands and tongues. And it's our turn now, while we're alive, to care for it. So tonight, from the heart of Tank 20, some fragments of Belief and Technique for Electronic Words. Everything you were taught about literature is a hoax. Philip Wolstetter, Invisible Seattle. Honor your journals, your sketchbooks, your notes, your doodles, and above everything else, your email. Language arts forms of the future are to be found there. Electric light at a restaurant table is a distraction anyway. I'm glad I'm seeing your face by candlelight. Once the power went out, the waiters and waitresses turned festive. The owner broke out free bottles of Retsina for everyone. They're cooking by flashlight back in the kitchen. Notice how great this tzatziki tastes by candlelight. Just as great as your knee feels under the table by candlelight. Just as great as the taramo salata feels under my elbow as I lean into it to lean over the table and kiss you. Duck, looks like we're getting free flaming cheese, too. Opa! Who declared that we can't use this sudden darkness to make up for a little lost kissing time? It's what the ancients would have done, right? It's said that the ancients perfected 1,100 forms of kissing. Instead of interrupting our kissing, the waiter stands with our entrees for who knows how long before we notice them out of the corners of our kiss-happy eyes. Shift the focus from the object to the experience. Be honest with yourself about how you read. Be ashamed of nothing. The audience is always right. Voltaire. As a small token of faith in the promise of electronic literature, I'd like to read a short passage from Blue Company 2002. Blue Company 2002, a repeat performance of last year's Tank 20 underground hit, A Story Told in a Month of Email, starting April 27th. Subscribe today at tank20.com. Blue Company is a series of emails from a shy marketing guy who's been transferred by his company to Italy, 14th century Italy. From the 21st email, what do May showers bring? June allergies? Few things are less comfortable than steel-armored gloves with the fingertips full of water. fun at the fair. As we rode today, some vineyard workers told us there was a fair a few villages down the pike. Oh, goody, we says to ourselves, thinking of the jolly fairs we saw in Burgundy. When we got to this fair, we hardly recognized it as such. 12-odd suspicious scammers crouched in their carts like foxholes and waited, like drug dealers, for wary locals to peek at their stolen bads. Mostly armor and military regalia, often with the blood still on it. A guy hung on to my stirrup and tried to sell me his wife, or if the upkeep daunted me, to rent her. The only shred of liveliness was a shrieking circle of all ages playing blanket toss with a limp youngster wearing red rouge cheek circles, who turned out, upon closer examination, to be dead. Demographic neutron bomb. 20 years ago, in 1348, the Black Death went through this area between Milan and Florence like a toothed scythe, slicing and sparing randomly. The 20-somethings who now run things around here are a damaged generation. Hard-bit, impulsive, pleasure-craving, numbed, terrified, careless. For example, the huge human dogfight, cockfight, fistfight at the fair over some accidentally bent long shoe toe. Post-traumatic stress, survivor guilt, unprocessed grief, inability to trust. These post-plague kids lived through the biblical end times and no longer know what time this is. When the white company came through, these people sold the white company poisoned wheat just for the fuck of it. Thank you for your undivided attention. Why do this? Because cliches are not just tiresome, they're harmful. Thank you and good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, administrators and users, readers, writers, and woe-readers, have I got a literary curiosity for you tonight. Here at this multimedia cabaret, a work of a single medium, which the ancients called text, and here at this montage of hypertexts, do they still have that? An entirely different sort of work, a text-generating, text-accepting, world-simulating machine, a sort of wordy hurdy-gurdy, which in a moment I will invite one of you from the audience to monkey with and grind against. But before I show this powerful organ interfacing with another human being, I will manipulate it myself for your instruction and amusement. The device is called ad verbum, which means verbatim, to translate Latin to Latin. It means, in other words, word for word. And I will let you know, so that you may fully appreciate the humor of the prologue, that Z is the command in such works, typically designating weight, and that the main character in these sorts of interactive fictions is often charged with collecting treasures and everything else that is lying around. With the cantankerous wizard of wordplay evicted from his mansion, the worthless plot can now be redeveloped. The city regulations declare, however, that the rip-down job can't proceed until all the items within have been removed. That's what the demolition contractor explains to you, anyway, as you stand eagerly on the adventurer's day laborer corner. Once he learns of your penchant for puzzle solving and your kleptomaniacal tendencies, he hires you for the job. You hop into the bed of his truck, type a few Z's, and arrive at the site, eager. Adverbum. Foyer. This is the mansion's spacious ground floor antechamber. The wallpaper is peeling, and bits of plaster have fallen from the ceiling here and there. There is a stairway, stable enough to ascend. The big area to the west must have once been a separate room, but the demolition crew seems to have already taken out a wall. A living room is east. On the south side is the front door. A dumpster has been dumped here. The contractor clears his throat and points at the big dumpster. Forget the fixtures, but pick up everything that's not bolted down, including the stuff out back. Then, drop off all the debris, treasures, right here. He scrawls something on the dumpster with a marker. Good luck. The contractor hurries out the front door, which slams closed, leaving you alone. You spot a door to the north, leading out back. It is shut quite tight. Read the dumpster. It's made of steel and almost entirely open on one end for easy deposition of debris. Scrawled across it is the phrase, atrophy case. Perhaps the contractor left out a space when labeling it. Walk east. Living room. This huge, bare living room occupies about half the mansion's ground floor. Your object-sensitive eyes notice verbosifier. Take the verbosifier. I was going to look at it, but really we just want to take it, don't we? Take it. West. I won't read this again. Put the verbosifier in the dumpster. You put the verbosifier into the dumpster. Climb the stairs. Initial lobby. The lobby of the mansion's initial floor, the one above the ground floor, is an ordinary and fairly well-maintained room. There are some things scrawled on the ground here in the contractor's handwriting. One object is written to the north. Wall toward the other three exits on this floor, two is scrawled. The stairway that runs down to the foyer turns and continues up to the next floor. The constrained passages to the north, east, west, and south look as if they might spell trouble. Or perhaps they simply spell news. Go up. Antepenultimate lobby. This lobby, allowing access to the rooms to the next to top floor, is in good shape. It is very similar to the lobby below, although the ceiling may be a bit lower. Here, there are only three passages. Two of them, to the north and east, are normal passages, but one to the south is oddly constrained. It has an ominous sign above it. The main stairway leads down, while another staircase, straight and narrow, allows passage up to the next floor. Go north. Bedroom. Even the light fixture has been removed from this squarish bedroom, which is in much better repair than most of the rest of the house. It seems to have been freshly painted in pus. The exit is south. A pig sits here calmly. He is quiet and oddly attired. Examine the pig. The pig seems extremely well behaved, even a bit stately. He is wearing a distinctive toga. Pig, hello. The pig glances to you as you speak, but quickly looks away as if not understanding your language. Igpe, Elohe. The pig looks up at you with a smile, understanding the language you're speaking. The pig nods to you in greeting, letting out a very civil snort. South. Antepenultimate lobby. Down. Initial lobby. South. A pillow-like force keeps you from moving that way. A sonorous voice booms out in attempted hollowness. You may be very, very frustrated if you walk in there without reading the warning. Sure, maybe you read the warning 3 years ago in some other game session and you remember it perfectly. But how do I know that? I'm not supposed to let you in unless I know you've read it. It's like an airline flight attendant has to keep showing you how to use a seatbelt, even if you've been on a plane for a third of your life. There's a hollow sigh. So just go on and read the warning by typing warning, and then I'll let you in. All right, now this is legal nonsense. So we'll move on to the south, and I'll ask for a volunteer to come and try to fathom the southern room of the initial floor. Someone? Someone? Yes, yes, yes. And for others who want to participate but were more shy than Dina, I will allow you to yell things to her, which she may choose to ignore or not. We're in the sloppy salon. Simple social space, sadly spoiled. Some skewed situations sequel, surely. Seemingly, slovenly students sojourned. Scraping, scratching, scuffing surfaces. Stuff. Stainless steel stapler, sizable sofa. And here we have an epigraph from some work of print literature. Just type. Oops, let me see. Okay, just try again. Okay. Take stuff. Stop, stop. Show some sense. Scribble suitable strings. Swipe stuff. Some sight seems suppressed. Perhaps stuff is not a word. Suppressed sight. Sorry, semantic shrouded. Seize stapler. Seized. Seize sofa. Sizable sofa sits solidly. Stubborn. Throw stapler at sofa. Stop, stop. Show some sense. Scribble suitable strings. Throw, stop, stop. Swipe sofa, sizable. Staple sofa, staplers, sans staples. Staplings, senseless. Fill the stapler with good staples. Stop, stop, sinful speech. Select superior symbols. I don't think she's gotten it yet, has she? Fill stapler with symbols. Stop, stop, sinful speech. Select superior. Search sofa. Searching sofa seems. Some Sue stuck. Sadly, sofa's surface slick. Swallow sofa. Swinish swallower. Sipping sizable sofa shouldn't seem savory. Uh-oh. Get to the pig and ask the pig to wallow say ofa say. Why don't you try leaving the room? Yes. Leave room is the suggestion. Stop, stop. Sinful speech. The difficulty here is that this room, of course, the exit is to the north. North. Stop, stop. Look for exit. Stop. Step on sofa. On sofa? All right, I'm afraid that what we have to do to get out of this is simply...
Escape. Of course.
Skedaddle. Thank you.
Literature with alliteration. Well, I'm probably going to get into a little bit of trouble for this next piece of electronic literature. Pre-press is an electronic process. Desktop publishing, writing with your word. Type of technology. But anyway, we thought we'd throw a book in here just to kind of throw things off kilter a little bit. But a very special book by a very special girl. Shelley Jackson, the author of Patchwork Girl and The Doll Games, which is also a great work read by Shelley. I did, in exchange for helping Shelley Jackson to launch her tour for her print book, The Melancholy of Anatomy, for which she was selected as a Village Voice writer on The Verge last year, I did make her promise to read Patchwork Girl in the sculpture garden for the video cameras later sometime in this visit. And we'll put that on the 2001 Awards CD-ROM. But anyway, tonight we thought we'd hearken back a little bit to the future with The Melancholy of Anatomy by Shelley Jackson.
Well, actually, Scott's misunderstood this a little bit, because what this actually is... a really small laptop, and you all know that I'm kind of fascinated with stuff, the materiality of things, and here I'm experimenting with encoding electronic impulses in kind of material objects like ink and paper pulp. It's not that newfangled, because it's basically just like a hypertext, only you can read it in any order. But just to make things simple, I'm going to read this story through right from the beginning. It's called Fetus. The first fetus was sighted in the abandoned hangar outside our town. Just floating there, almost weightless, it drifted down until its coiled spine rested on the concrete and then sprang up again with a flex of that powerful part. Then the slow descent began afresh. It was not hiding. It was not doing anything except possibly looking, if it could see anything from between its slitted lids. What was it looking at? Possibly the motes of dust as they drifted through the isolated rays of sun and changed direction all at once like birds flying together. Or at the runic marks of rust and bird shit on the walls. Maybe it was trying to understand them, though that might be imposing too much human order on the fetus, who is known now for being interested in things for, as they say, their own sake, incomprehensible motive to most of us. The fetus rarely opens its eyes when anyone is watching, but we know they are deep blue-black, like a night sky when space shows through it, and its gaze is solemn, tender, yet so grand as to be almost murderous. We weren't afraid, said little Brent Hadley, who with his cousin Jean Hadley made the discovery and took the first photos, we've all seen them, with his little point and shoot. We thought it was Mr. Fisher in one of his costumes. Mr. Fisher is one of those small-town loonies affectionately tolerated by the locals. He did indeed don a fetus costume later on and paraded down to the Handy Mart parking lot, where he gulled some big city newsmen to their chagrin. Then my daddy came and said, "Cut the fooling, Fisher." But even when the Fisher hypothesis had been disproved, no one felt anything but gentle curiosity about the visitor. Indeed, they scarcely noticed it had drifted near the small crowd while they debated and trailed after them when they left. The fetus is preternaturally strong. It grabs its aides and knocks their bald heads together. It carries pregnant women across busy streets. It helps with the groceries. These are the little ways it enters the daily life of its parishioners. It turns over the soil in an old woman's garden. It lifts waitresses on tables to show off their legs. The fetus has a formal appreciation for old-fashioned chivalry and expects to be thanked for such gestures. The fetus roved about the town until it found a resting place to its liking in the playground of the municipal park among dogs and babies. The mothers and the professional loiterers appointed themselves guards and watched it sternly, heading off the youngsters who veered too near it. But they softened to it over time, began to bring sandwiches and lemonade along, and make casual speculations about the fetus's lifespan, hopes, and origins. When the crowd of tourists pressed too close, they became the fetus's protectors and formed a human chain to keep them out. Nobody's enemy and nobody's friend, it hides its heart in a locked box, a secret stash, maybe a hollow tree in the woods under a bee's nest, maybe a tower room on a glass mountain, on a wolf-run isle in a sea ringed by volcanoes and desert wastes. The fetus always keeps its balance. Someone noticed that the land seemed disarranged. Bent treetops, flattened grass, weeds dragged out of their seats, clods dislodged. Tedious speculations about crop circles and barrows and Andean landing strips made the rounds. Of course, we knew the fetus's little feet dragged when he walked. We had seen the marks in the sandbox at the park. We should have noticed the resemblance, but we resisted the idea that the fetus was only a transient resident. We had grown accustomed to, even proud of it. The fetus was a municipal landmark. It had put our town on the map and filled it with visitors so that our children had a chance to envy the latest haircuts and our adults the latest cars and sexual arrangements. Plus, the marks were disturbing. They were careless. They passed over, sometimes through fences, even when the gate swung close at hand. Mrs. Sender's oleanders were uprooted and dragged for miles. Even after we knew the fetus caused the marks, a mystery clung to them. For everything the fetus did, though, there was someone to praise it. Followers did their following on the paths it left. They said the paths proposed an aesthetic that could not at once be grasped. Some began dragging a foot behind them as they walked, scorning markless movement as noncommittal, therefore cowardly. But why was the fetus so restless? Was it seeking something? We had all seen it peering through our curtains in the evening and found the marks in our flower beds in the morning. Was it exercising or aimlessly wandering? Or was it writing a kind of message on the earth? Was it driven from rest by some torment, a plague personal to it, a plaguey thought it couldn't shake? Was the fetus guilty? Since the fetus arrived, none of us has loved without regret, fucked without apprehension, yearned without doubt. We break out in a rash when a loved one comes near because we know the fetus is there too, waiting for us to prove to it everything it already knows. Was the fetus a fetus? Indeed, it resembled one, but if it was, the question had to be raised, when the fetus grew up, as it must, what would it become? Perhaps we all breathed a sigh of relief when scientists concluded that the fetus, like the famous axolotl, was a creature permanently immature. Hence its enormous susceptibility, its patience, and its eagerness to please. Like the unicorn, it adored virgins, but it had a raging fascination with sexual doings, a fascination that drove April Tip and the rest of her gang, the bad girls and boys of our town, to cruel displays under the streetlights around the park. At first, though not for long, we believed our fetus was unique. Of course, we speculated about the home it must have had somewhere else, about others. But here on Earth, it seemed a prodigy, the prodigy. Soon, however, more of them began to appear. Some dropped out of the sky, people said, slowly and beautifully, their light heads buoying them up. Commentators waxed eloquent and bade us to imagine on the blue a dot that grew to a pink dot that grew to a Cupid doll that became the creature we know now. Many were found like the first one, swaying gently in some warm and secret enclosure, warehouses, high school gyms, YMCA dressing rooms. Publicity seekers claim to have come across fetuses in infancy, tiny, playful, and virtually blind. Like kittens, they bumbled around, falling on their oversized heads, and eagerly sucked on a baby finger, or indeed anything of like size and shape. One was reportedly discovered in a bird's nest, opening its tiny, translucent lips among the beaks. But fetuses this small have never been held in captivity, or even captured on film. Whether that is because the susceptible creatures lose themselves in their surroundings, striving to become air, a patch of dirt, a falling leaf, or because they never existed in the first place, hardly matters. For the situation remains that none are found, except in stories that are already far from firsthand by the time they reach a credible authority. But we may pause for a minute to wonder whether, if such kittens do exist, they are the offspring of our original fetus, who, for all we know, may be capable of fertilizing itself like some plants, or if they grow from spores that have drifted here from some impersonally maternal comet, or, most mysterious thought of all, whether they spring up in our world self-generated, as sometimes new diseases seem to do, teaching us new pains just because the world has left a place for them. Behind one another's eyes, it is the fetus we love, floating in the pupil like a speck, like a spy. It's looking over your shoulder, making cold drinks even colder, and it doesn't care what promises you've made. We think we want affection, sympathy, fellow feeling, but it is the cold and absolute we love. And when we misplace that in one another, we struggle for breath. Through the pupil's little peephole, we look for it, the shapeless, the inhuman. Of course, with such a company of admirers, sycophants, interpreters, opportunists, advisors, prophets, and the like behind it, it wasn't long before the fetus was performing many of the offices once seen to by our local pastor, visiting the sick, hosting charitable functions, giving succor to troubled souls. One day, Pastor Green simply left town, and no one was very sorry. It was the graceful thing to do, people agreed, and saw to it that the fetus stood behind the pulpit the next Sunday. At first, it held an honorary post. We couldn't settle on a suitable title, but we did present it with a robe and a stiff white collar, which it seemed to admire. Higher-ups in church office were rumored to be uneasy about this unorthodox appointment, but public feeling was behind it, and there was no question that the fetus would increase the church's subscription thousandfold. No one had ever seen such a benefit potluck as the first one hosted by the fetus. It wielded the ice cream scoop with tireless arm and paid personal attention to every dessert plate. The fetus is made of something like our flesh, but not the same. It is a sort of überflesh, rife with potentialities, for the fetus is, of course, incomplete, always, unfinished, perpetually. It is malleable beyond our understanding, hence unutterably tender, yet also resilient. The fetus learns from what it neighbors and may become what it too closely neighbors. Then your fetus may cease to be. You may find yourself short one member of the household, yet in possession of a superfluous chair, a second stove, a matching dresser. The fetus sees merit in everything. This is why it brings joy to houses with its innocence and is loved by children. But this quality is also its defect. A fetus will adore a book of matches and seek to become it. The fetus is here to serve us. If we capture it, it will do our bidding. We can bind its great head with leather straps, cinch its little hips tight. Then the fetus willingly pulls a plow, trots lovers through a park, serves salad at a cookout. It does not scorn menial tasks, for to it all endeavors are equally strange, equally marvelous. Only when it is time to make love must you bind the fetus tight, lock it in its traces, close all the doors and windows. For at that moment, the fetus will rise in its bonds, larger and more majestic, and its great eyes will open, and inside them, you could see all of space rushing away from us. As it is, it is. The fetus is sublime at that moment. Set guards, and they will respectfully retreat. Dogs, they will lie down with their heads between their paws, blinking. And even if the fetus is in tight restraint, you will feel it risen in your pleasure bed. The air will turn blue and burn like peppermint on your wet skin, and the shadows under the bed and the corners of the room will take on the black vastness and the finality of space. You will continue loving, because that is our human agenda, what is set for us to do, though we know the fetus, whom we also love, is suffering in its straps. Indeed, we make the fetus suffer again and again, though we are full of regret and pity. And these feelings swell in our chests and propel us together with ever greater force. So we seem to hear the fetus's giant cry, deafening, every time we slam together. We love cruelly and in pain. Thanks.